My labs are in rack two, so they're as far away from the UW campus as you can get without actually going on someone else's land. So there, if you go to the industrial park on the north side of the UW campus, and you go as far north and as far west as you can, that's our labs. And at some point, we'll get you over there to see them. So I've taught a version of this course every year that Psi's been in existence. And it started off as a course which I called quantum parlor tricks, with the idea being that we had small quantum systems. We would show you some ideas, but you know, they were so nascent that they would help you get some insight into what quantum mechanics were doing. But if you were a card-carrying physicist, you weren't going to roll up your sleeves and try to actually learn something. And that's changed. This past year, there's been more than six groups, mine including, that have publicly said we're going to have 100-qubit quantum computers, and that we're going to have those before you guys get your PhDs, unless you're planning on getting your PhD really, really quickly. And 100 qubits is at the level that it should be interesting, right? That, you know, if you take your laptops, it's easy to simulate a few handfuls of qubits. You take the biggest computer that the U.S. government admits to having, and it can simulate 30-some-odd qubits. And you take all of the resources in the classical universe, and you assign them as bits. You wouldn't be able to store a number that's as large as 300, as a general 300-qubit state. And so 100 is already interesting in that it challenges our ideas of what we could do classically. It also challenges our ideas of what we can do quantum mechanically. But the way I want to teach the course this year is to say, oh yes, there are quantum devices that you will have your hands on. And you want to be able to understand how they work, to propose experiments. I want to try to convince you that you can understand the full complexity of a quantum device, and that you can propose an experiment that is honest about that full complexity. I'm an experimentalist, and it irks me when a theorist proposes an experiment which pretends that the Hamiltonian is something they can pluck out of the air, and all the difficulty is hidden by them just dropping terms. And so this is my chance to make sure that you won't do that. So let's think about quantum devices. And ones that you might want to look at. Sensors are a good example. Today, the best magnetic sensors are coherent. So already, if you want to have a sensor for magnetism or for charge, those sensors operate uniquely quantum mechanically. And there's an opportunity today that we're building in small quantum processors to give us even more power. And we'll show you some of that. Actuators. If I want to control transport, or if I want to cool a system, these behave quantum mechanically. So transport here means I'm taking an electron, or I'm taking a quasi-particle, or I'm taking a spin and I'm moving it. Doesn't mean we're taking the bus. And transport or cooling are good examples of things that we do today with quantum actuators. I think the big one is simulators. And these are starting to be useful. If you look at results coming out of Berkeley, NIST, MIT, Harvard, Maryland, there are now small simulators that you can run a multi-body problem on and start to learn. And you know the most widespread is, does this Hamiltonian, write down your favorite one, predict superconductivity? But there's a lot of other problems we would like to know too. These we're going to talk about. Communication. We won't talk about. But quantum key distribution, that's already commercial. So, you know, we won't talk about it because you can buy it today and use it, and you don't need to know anything about quantum mechanics to use it. So you missed your chance there. And then, as I said, there are processors, 100 qubits, which you should not confuse with being a quantum computer. There are no quantum computers. If any of you guys own stock in D-Wave, you know, we should talk later. But you can make small quantum processors, and they are useful. Now, the issue, of course, is how do we engineer these things? How do we control them? I want to go through a couple of examples. And the way I'm going to run the course is we'll spend about each of the 3 weeks looking at some simple quantum system and wanted to show you what quantum systems look like when you need to worry about all the details. And two, so that you can answer a problem. I think one of the ways of getting engaged is that I give you a problem that's at the forefront of the field and I ask you to solve it. Now, it'll be an open-ended question. So, you know, you won't solve it completely, but within the time that you have available for this class, you will be able to make interesting suggestions and you'll be able to go through the analysis and know how good your solutions are. And that's, of course, the challenge with physics, that physics is really good when you bring an experiment to it and you say, tell me what would happen. We can calculate that. But when you go and you say, okay, I want to do this, physics doesn't help you. So you need to bring some insight and suggest an experiment, and then physics can help you. So we're going to go through three, maybe four quantum systems. And I want each of these quantum systems to have a simple Hilbert space. I don't want to be teaching you extra stuff. I don't want to have to teach you the Russell-Saunders coupling for atomic and molecular systems. I don't want to have to teach you solid-state physics. So we're going to look for systems that have a simple Hilbert space where we can introduce the full Hamiltonian, because it just irks me to pretend, where there's really good coherent control and where experiments are being done today. And the first of these is neutron interferometry. And it's a really simple idea. We take a neutron beam and we split it coherently over two paths. And I'll tell you how we do that. We do it by Bragg scattering, but I'll show you that. And so we have neutrons coming in, neutrons going out. There's a set of detectors. And if I put something in one of those paths, then I can measure the coherent cross-section, right? If I put something in one path, then the neutron will be delayed or sped up in that path. And therefore, we can say, oh, yes, I'll see a phase difference. I'll see the phase difference will show up as the intensity at my two detectors. And neutrons are wonderful because they penetrate, right? They have no charge. They're light, so they scatter off hydrogen. And they have spin, so they detect magnetism. So they're a wonderful way of probing magnetism inside materials. And a lot of the interest in neutrons is exactly that, that we've proposed lots of new magnetic materials. I hope that you've heard of topological insulators and Mariana fermions and all these nice things. Xiaogang taught you, so you should have. It would be nice to test them here. Neutrons are also a wonderful place to look for standard model physics, that if we could measure the cross-sectional change with a neutron going spin up or spin down in the gravitational field, then we can make a lot of progress to parameterizing the standard model. They're also a great way to look for dark energy and dark matter. They're even a reasonable way of looking for gravity waves. And so there's lots of ways you would connect to this, whether you're interested in materials, quantum materials, or more foundational questions in physics. And the question that I would like you to look at is to say, what happens if I put helium-3 there? We would love to know the coherent cross-section of helium-3 precisely. But you might know that helium-3 loves to detect a neutron, right? It absorbs neutrons. That's why when you drive into the States, there's these big, I think they're orange posts there that are full of helium-3 that are detecting if you're bringing anything into the States that's spewing out neutrons. And so if I want to measure a coherent cross-section, it's a drag if it's capturing all my neutrons. And I'm going to ask you to look at a process where we have an interaction-free measurement, where we measure the cross-section of the neutron in helium-3. But in the limit of a long measurement, we don't put any neutrons into the helium-3. And you'll be able to do that. From there, we're going to go to magnetic resonance. In a neutron case, the Hilbert space is really small. We have two paths. Some experiments, we have four paths. There's a spin for the neutron. So you get 2 to 3 qubits out of it. But we can say every little thing that goes on. In magnetic resonance, we have a lovely tensor product structure for the Hilbert space. So we can make this as large as we want. And here, we're going to be able to look at simulations. I'm going to come back to that in just a second. And I should say, though, you probably know, magnetic resonance, I mean, it's used everywhere, right? That it's used medically for magnetic resonance imaging. It's used in chemistry. It's used in material science. It's used to study magnetic materials. It's also used to measure dark matter, that the most precise detector for dark matter today is based upon magnetic resonance. And the most precise measurement of the charge to mass ratio of the electron was made with magnetic resonance. So there's a lot of foundational pieces. Magnetic resonance also has a particularly nice piece in that it was the first coherent spectroscopy that already in the 1940s, so long predating the development of the density matrix, we had coherent spectroscopy in nuclear magnetic resonance. And the methods of control and the language of coherent control all grew out of efforts in magnetic resonance. Okay, so then we go and look at the defect, nitrogen vacancy, in diamond. And this is an optics experiment. Again, the Hilbert space is small, but what's lovely about this defect is it's coherent, and the whole experiment you can walk around with. So here, you know, if I want to do neutron interferometry, I need a reactor. So I need to be at NIST, National Institute of Science and Technology. If I want to do magnetic resonance, I almost always need a large magnetic field, so I have a superconducting magnet. So you're not going to go walking around with that. But a nitrogen vacancy in diamond, you need a laser pointer and a diamond. And so that you can walk around with. And it gives you a chance to show that quantum devices, we can get them out of the lab, and we can connect them. You know, if you have sensors, actuators, you want them to be out of the lab. So we'll see that as well. Now, if I have time, I'll also talk about superconducting qubits. And I should have said, here we have a spin and a magnetic field. Magnetic field, a spin, processes. That's the whole physics. Here I have two spins, and there's an exchange coupling between them. And it's the exchange coupling that it replaces the magnetic field. And here I have a current loop, and I pinch it. Take a pair of pliers and pinch it. So if I have a current loop and it's superconducting, then of course the wave function must be continuous. But if I pinch it, then I can have a controlled phase difference across that wave function. And that's the whole physics for that. Though we'll try to make it sound more complicated. Now, of course, there's a lot of things I haven't put on there. I could have put trapped ions. I could have put trapped atoms, Rydberg states, quantum dots, linear optics, transporting quantum materials. Lots and lots and lots of really fascinating systems. But I want to make sure that we go through a few and we get all the physics right, rather than give you a survey of everything that's out there. All right. So now, let me spend a couple minutes on simulation, because I hope that that's near and dear to your heart. So we're talking here about magnetic resonance. And this is an old, old field that in 1957 about, Pierre Degen, who I hope you know, was working on his PhD. And you should know him from condensed matter. You should know him from reptation theory. He won a Nobel Prize. He worked a lot in describing the coupling of cavities and photons. He developed the early ideas of liquid crystals. But in his PhD, he started off as an experimentalist, working with Anatole Abragam. And Abragam sets him a really simple experiment that was impossible to realize, which is the bane of experimentalists. He says, take a cubic lattice of spin 1/2 particles. So each particle is a spin. And I'll give you the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian of this is the sum over the lattice of some constant, which I don't really care about, the distance between two spins to the third power. It's a dipole-dipole interaction between the spins. So minus one. And this angle is the angle between the internuclear vector of the two atoms and some applied magnetic field. You have to have a magnetic field. And then the spin dependence is a so-called flip-flop term, which again, you probably have seen in condensed matter. And let me say that you should ask questions. And when I say you've probably seen and you've never seen it in your life, you know, just stop and tell me I'm an idiot. It's okay. So we've got this piece here. And what this Hamiltonian does, it says if the spins are anti-aligned, then they can both flip. And that looks like a transport, right? The spin ended up over here. So this term looks like it leads to spin transport. And so what Avragam asked Degen to do was to measure the effective diffusion rate. That if you have these spins and they're flipping, and there's lots and lots of them, then why not think that the motion would appear to be roughly diffusive? So he says, measure D, the spin diffusion rate. And he even gave him a crystal. The crystal is calcium fluoride, which has a cubic lattice. And the frequency, so this term here, I can write it as a correlation time. So the rate at which two spins are flipping, if they're flipping fast, is 6 microseconds. So he says, well, okay, if each nearest neighbor is flipping by 6 microseconds, and the system is coherent, so the T1 of this system is about, well, a few hours. And the T1 says, how long does it take to come in thermal equilibrium? Okay, we'll see more about it. And the coherence time for this system, how long do we keep phase coherence? So phase coherence is about 100 seconds. So actually, that was a pretty nice quantum computer. It said that you could have a Hilbert space. If you have a cubic millimeter of spins, then you have about 10 to the 18 spins. So I give you 10 to the 18 spins, and I tell you that the coherence time is 100 seconds, and the operation time is 6 microseconds, so we can do something like 10 to the 8th operations. And if we could do that, and we could program something other than just this one Hamiltonian, we'd be really happy. But of course, this is what we get. Okay, so Degen tried to do the experiment. He couldn't figure it out, which is not surprising. The experiment wasn't done until the early 1990s. So, you know, you have to cut him some slack that if you try to do something and it takes the next guy 40 years to do it, then you shouldn't apologize. But then he said, okay, he would think about it theoretically. But of course, the theory problem is coherent. It's a multi-body problem. So Degen works on this, and he gets a number. And since there's nothing to compare the number to, he stops and moves on. But then people asked, well, what if instead of trying to get a number, I ask, what is the ratio of two spins diffusing together and one spin diffusing by itself? If I take a ratio, then we would say, well, this somehow should be geometric related to that Hamiltonian. So this will give us more insight than just coming up with a number. And So Degen tried to answer this, and he came up with the number 1. And then a number of people looked at it and said, no, that can't be right. Because if I have 2 spins moving, then there are more ways they can move. Instead of moving like this, they can cross. It still has to be 1 up and 1 down. So being brilliant, they said the answer was 2. And then they said, well, you know, actually, because there are 2 modes to that, the answer is 4. And then Feynman said, no, the answer is 8. And Feynman was very nice. Feynman showed that if you're diffusing this way, or I'm over here, I'm diffusing that way, it's the same process. So everything gets sped up again. And of course, what happens is every time you can imagine some mode, things get faster. That's the benefit of quantum mechanics, that we can have interference effects, and everything will get faster and faster and faster. And then experimentally, it's greater than 12, which, you know, is pretty good. It says, oh, now they got most of the local stuff right, yeah? But the system's coherent. It's coherent over 10 to the 8th time steps. And so no one's going to integrate over 10 to the 8th time steps to see every possible interference effect. And of course, it's challenging because it falls off only as 1 over r cubed, over a cubic lattice. So it's conditionally divergent, right? So everything is posed against you. And what's been happening for this past 40 years is people would say, okay, let me tell you a simple system. This is a really simple problem. And then let me get a number for you. Now we have experimental numbers. And then use it to develop approximation methods that we can use to learn about multi-body physics. Now we're going to change that. We're going to say, oh no, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have my quantum system. And let's start with just 100 qubits, because 100 qubits is already quite a lot. Okay, it's not 10 to the 19, but it's better than what we can do in our laptops. And now you ask, well, let me come up with some good initial state. Let me come up with a Hamiltonian that is about the Hamiltonian I want. But you know, maybe since the interaction strength is falling off as 1 over r cubed, it might be enough to keep the nearest neighbors or the next nearest neighbors, right? The next nearest neighbors are already down by a factor of 8. You know, if I keep the next nearest neighbors, you know, it really gets small. Maybe I don't need all those. So maybe have a simpler Hamiltonian. We have some time. We'll get an output of this. And of course, if you were doing a classical simulation of your quantum system, you would be done, right? Because your classical simulation would give you this output state. But we're not doing that. We're doing a quantum simulation. And so then we need to say, ah, I need to tell you what the measurement operator is so that I get a result. We get some expectation value. And it's not at all clear to say what's in the best initial state, or what's a good enough Hamiltonian, or even harder, what measurement should I make to record that I have a diffusion coefficient? Because the diffusion coefficient is not a term in this Hamiltonian, right? The dipolar frequencies are. So what's the measurement that's going to allow me to get this out? And we wanted to explore these questions. And I don't want to explore them in this system because it's been done. And I'll tell you, it's easy. You say, ah, I take the Z magnetization, I write it as a grading over some space. And then I look at the sum of the magnetization. And of course, if it's diffusive, then this grating will attenuate. And in fact, Lord Rayleigh said that quite some years ago. A few centuries ago now. So the problem that I want you to do, and you know, it's tempting, you know, we're in class here to say, well, why don't I just give you a one-dimensional problem? Because everyone can solve one-dimensional problems. But the one-dimensional problem in tight binding, there's a classic solution that's known that you can map onto a fermionic system. So it's boring. And we don't do anything boring, I hope. So instead, I'm going to give you a triangular lattice. And we're going to look at spin on this triangular lattice. And you're going to show me that in the first excitation manifolds, where this is 1, 2, and 3, etc., right? And there's two first excitation manifolds, or two single excitation manifolds. That you can arrange a Hamiltonian that has an edge current of spin. So that if the spin is up, it'll move clockwise, and if it's down, it'll move counterclockwise. So this will look just like spin polarized edge states, what perhaps you've heard of as fermions. There's no charge, it's only spin. So it will be a churned insulator. And you'll show me that you can get churn numbers out of this and that you can start to understand the physics behind topological structures by having a small quantum system that you run to give you that insight. And so that you can connect the theory that you've seen, I hope, in other groups, to an experiment and suggest, hey, if I want to find the gauge of this, this is how I would do it. This is how a gauge effect would show up. Okay? Now, again, all of these, I'm not going to show you the other questions I want you to do. All of them, there's an awful lot of analysis you could do. And what I'm hoping is that these tutorial problems, as a group, you'll work through, that not everyone will do the same thing, and that you'll use them as a way of getting some insight and hopefully raising some interest in using quantum processors. And I will promise you that in your career, using a quantum processor to understand physics will become a very common occurrence. Now, let's turn actually to today's subject in the couple seconds we have left in the class, which is neutron interferometry. So I want to start with a really, really, really simple system. And I'll draw it over here. Now, let me also say, I'll hand out, and I'll try to do it before classes, a Mathematica notebook for each of the lectures. And the Mathematica notebook will have all of the analysis and a much greater detailed description than anything I can cover in class. So, you know, you can go through that and see things in great detail. And I'll also hand out with those a CDF file. So if you don't have or like to use Mathematica, you can load a CDF reader for free on your computer and you can look at it there. So what we do is we take a silicon single crystal, and it's large. And I come in with a monoenergetic neutron beam. So a neutron beam coming in with just one momentum. And it's going to interact via Bragg scattering. And so it's in the so-called Lowy geometry. And so what we're looking at is two transmitted beams of neutrons. And the way we're going to treat this is I'm going to recombine these eventually. So these are passive or neutron. And let me use this coordinate system. So I want to, be able to label the paths in a convenient way. And so we'll say that 0 corresponds to kx greater than 0, and 1 corresponds to kx less than 0. All right, so then we can say that, oh yes, I have a beam coming in. It's in that state. And then it's going to interact with this beam splitter, right? It's a beam splitter because you get one beam in and two beams out. And if this was a 50-50 beam splitter, then we would see an operation like this, that the state 0 would go to an equal superposition of 0 and 1. Okay? And this piece looks quite close to a Hadamard. So you've heard that, I hope, in Joseph's course? Yeah, thanks. So in a Hadamard, then the operation for a Hadamard is this. And I write it like this to say, I've put the square root of 2 to normalize the length of those two Pauli operators. And I'm going to put that factor of 2 here. I've put this factor of 2 because if we're exponentiating Pauli operators, we always end up with an extra factor of 1/2. And pi is the angle of rotation. And so if we were to draw this we're rotating about this direction, x plus z, and we're rotating by 180 degrees. And if we have labeled on our block sphere those two states, we create an equal superposition. What I'm drawing here for the blade is this, where we are rotating about the y-axis. We're rotating in a negative sense, and the angle is pi over 2. And so now then, I'm rotating from here to there in this direction. And of course, if I start off with the zero state, I end up in exactly the same equal superposition of those two. Okay, so this is like a Hadamard, but the important piece is that it creates an equal superposition. We go into a second blade. At the second blade, the same thing is going to happen that happened at the first blade, that we're going to have two paths coming out. And I'm going to draw first the third blade. So at the third blade, the two paths meet. And I didn't say, but what I'm trying to indicate here is those are the crystal planes. If you want to allow a geometry, that's the way the crystal plane should be aligned. And we have two paths coming out. Now, these two paths we're going to suppress. We'll put a piece of cadmium here. And cadmium is great at absorbing neutrons. If I put a millimeter of cadmium there, no neutron's going to make it through cadmium. And if I want to do this diffraction in silicon, then I need to have a wavelength of my neutron that's, say, 2.8 angstroms. And for that, the velocity of the neutron is about 1,500 meters per second. So these are slowly meandering neutrons. Okay? No relativistic effects here. This is really, really, really slow. And this distance is 10 centimeters. So it takes microns, it takes 10 microns for a neutron to get through the interferometer. Now notice what happens. We've thrown away half of our neutrons, right? Because every time a neutron goes through here, there would be a probability, which you can calculate, you should calculate, that it will leave the interferometer. And that means fully half the neutrons leave the interferometer and the other half come here. And we'll detect those there. And we invoke something called fair sampling, which is very important. It says we want to know that no neutron carries, that leaves the interferometer, carries any unique information. In other words, the neutrons that leave the interferometer are not special. Now we have to test that. You don't get that for free. But if I was to write the physics down without fair sampling, and I allowed these neutrons to be special, then the physics of what's happening in this blade could be much, much more complicated than it will appear when there is fair sampling. And I'll say, we've tested it, it's true, it's a good problem for you guys to think about of how do you guarantee fair sampling? How do you test that these are not special neutrons? Now, of course, at this blade, we have the same interaction as we had at the other blades. And so we have the same Hadamard arrangement. And so the two paths are recombined. And of course, since they're recombined, they'll interfere. And the detectors are helium-3. I already told you up here that we would like to measure the coherent cross-section of helium-3. But here, of course, what we're doing is we're absorbing. So we absorb helium-3. And so now what we end up with is tritium. And so we end up with the charged particle. And it's bloody easy to detect. Every neutron that comes in this path is absorbed in the helium-3. And every time we absorb a neutron, we can detect it. We miss no neutrons. Now, that's different than at the border when you're trying to sneak your plutonium into the states. And the reason, of course, is that these neutrons are slow, so they're easy to absorb. But neutrons are born fast, right? So if you have something generating neutrons, even with helium-3, it's not easy to detect every neutron. Easy to detect them, but not everyone. I want to keep fair sampling, so I'm going to throw away those two paths. And I want to describe what happens in this blade. So in this middle blade, this thing looks like that. Because remember our definition of the eigenstates. And so If this path is the state 0, this path, of course, is the state 1. And there's nothing unique about that, right? I could have said, oh, I want the upper path to be 0 and the lower path to be 1. And it would change this definition of the unitary, right? Then that unitary would be the identity. And you can see also what's happened here is that because I've normalized the system, then here in this unit, this the action of this middle blade appears to be unitary. No neutrons are lost, although we're losing half of our neutrons. And the reason is that we post-select. In other words, we only count those events where we detect a neutron. So the experiment is there's a neutron beam, and we count over here. But I don't know where the neutron is impinging upon this interferometer, right? The only thing I know is I've counted over here. And the neutron interferometer is incredibly sensitive to having the right momentum. So the way we make this is it's machined out of one piece of silicon. I'll show you that. So these blades are separate, but they're tied to a common base. So if I align the first blade, then because it's all one crystal, the second and third blades automatically are aligned, okay? And therefore, the acceptance, the chance that a neutron will actually undergo the interaction is that momentum spread raised to the third power. That's really, really, really narrow. So all the neutrons that come in here, there's 10 to the 14 neutrons per second. They all go this way, except one neutron per second has the right momentum and shows up over here. Okay, that's the one I care about. Now, this isn't the full story, because if I only did this, and if you calculated this, you would see that all the neutrons will end up over here in this arrangement. And so what we do is we add a phase flag. So I add a piece of silica. So remember back to the first week of quantum mechanics where you were solving Schrodinger's equation in one dimensions. And you change the level of the potential. So you change the level of the potential, then the velocity of the particles change. And that's what happens here. We change by putting in silica. Then we change the potential, in this case, the nuclear potential. And you can see that this length is longer than that length. And so during this time, when it's in the blade, the neutron's in the blade, it slows down. And of course, it's been slower longer here than it has here. And therefore, it'll pick up a phase shift. And so the phase shift looks like that. And you'll allow me to say that I'm going to throw away the global phase shift, right? I could have written it as saying, I have the phase in the upper blade and the phase in the lower blade. And then there would be two phases. But I could remove the phase in the lower blade because that's global and say, oh, I just have a phase difference in the upper blade. No? And so now then, we have this nice phase term. So depending upon how I rotate this phase flag, the neutron will end up here or it'll end up here. And of course, in general, there'll be a probability that the neutron reaches either of those detectors. And so we can plot that. My boards are always this messy. I hope it doesn't bother you. So this is the intensity versus that angle. Let's call it theta. And for historic reasons, which are boring, the two detectors are called O and H. And so we can arrange that the neutrons are in one path or the other. And we can go through and calculate it. You have everything you need to calculate it right now. So let me just share with you a quick problem, and then I'll go over the notes really, really quickly. So if you would turn on the screen, and I'll do this over here. Take the interferometer. Let's draw it like this. And let me set this face so that all the neutrons show up here. Okay? And then what I'm going to do, and I can do that, of course. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a piece of cadmium here. When I put a piece of cadmium there, what happens? Yeah? Did you have an answer? Yes, the neutron is absorbed. What happens at the detectors? What do I see? What was that? I'm sorry. I see equal probability that they arrive at both the detectors because, of course, now I only have one beam coming in and it goes both ways. And this simple example that already shows you that with even something as trivial as a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, right? This is a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. That you must describe it by quantum mechanically, that there is not a classical solution that would give you the correct answer. There isn't a set of classical probabilities that would describe that. Okay, so that's nice. I see it well here. Okay, there we go. Okay, so this is what these notebooks look like. Just some background stuff. This is what the interferometers actually look like. As I said, they're cut from a solid piece of silicon. It's about this big. It is one single crystal. It is very low displacement. So certain types of defects are very rare. And you can see, you know, this is a good example that we have this three-blade geometry just as we've described in the system. I give you some nice things of, there's the reactor, that's how a reactor looks. Some momenta. Read through it. Ask questions as you like. But there's the actual data. And this is a really, really good data set. And you can see it doesn't quite look like this. It looks sort of like it, right? We have sines and cosines at the two detectors. It's really, of course, 1 plus cosine, 1 minus cosine. But you can see that it never goes down to 0. And that in one of the detectors, there's always a lot of neutrons. And so before we go and we say, oh, well, we have this simple model, what we want to know is, hey, what do we need to add to the model in terms of physics to get the right results and to fully capture what the experiment's going to tell us, right? Because if you can't capture fully the experiment, then you shouldn't be going off and describing some other experiment. Now, throughout the notebook, I include a bunch of problems. That's for you to figure out. You know, the idea isn't that I expect you to spend your time working through them all. I do expect you to think about them. I do hope you think about them. I hope you look at the notes. But you're going to get a lot more out of trying to solve the tutorial problems than you would get solving homework problems. You know, you can all take these unitaries, multiply them together, and tell me this is the action of the interferometer, right? So that piece we'll just take for granted. And if there's ever any questions, you come back and ask me, right? But think about the tutorials, but look at the problems I give in the notes, okay? And I do hear somewhere, take a really simple model of the probability of the beam splitters being not 50-50 for the first and second one. And in general, I'll put things on sliders so that you can play around with them. But you'll have an easy time showing that this actually doesn't capture what's going on. This is not the reason. It's an easy thing to suggest that, well, okay, they're not really 50-50, which they're not really 50-50. But that's not the piece that's limiting, that's giving us the result we saw. And so we'll talk about that more tomorrow. Any questions? Okay, then let's stop here.